Hello and welcome to Northeast Access Radio. We're coming to you on the Frequency 90.3, and also welcome to the Senior Citizens Programme. And in the studio we have some two junior senior citizens. They just about qualify for to be senior citizens. They're not senior citizens. And this is a continuation of the programmes we had for the last couple of weeks. And about talking about your mother's and father's time and what influence they had on you and what experience they gave you, coming life, as they say, and preparing you for the future. And, of course, the future is now with us. And, you know, whatever it's going to hold with all that's going on at the moment, and, of course, talking about the digital age, I can't hardly spell digital. Don't mind about the age. The age is one, we know all about the age, but we can't hardly spell digital. And, like I say, I'm still with pigeon posts, and that old pigeon I was getting old too, and I can't get the little band around its legs. It just be, I think it's got arthritis or something. But Declan, how are you, Declan?
I'm great, thanks for the God, yeah.
And of course, this is our drama man. You know, drama and all sorts of presentations with regard to all types of bits and pieces. And I believe he's doing Romeo and Juliet now, but he got the names wrong. Is that right, Declan?
We're doing a play very shortly. We just started, actually, and we're having a rehearsal on Wednesday. It's an interpretation of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, well, you'll be sued liable.
No, but thanks for the God he's dead a good while.
It's copyright won't apply.
But it's called Ronnie and Julia.
Because uh-huh. So, you're not getting any better names than that.
It's based in a Dublin environment, and it incorporates drugs, and it mirrors the two families, the Montagues and the Capulets. Yeah, but it's very interesting. We've got two lovely young people.
And what sort of poison are you getting? Is it?
No, it's a gun and a
Well, that's the rage all at the moment. Unfortunately, you know. But the two families feuding. What's new in Dublin?
History says, you know, it just repeats, doesn't it? You know?
But however, we won't go there.
No.
We're going to the past now. In your younger days, well, in your adolescence or whatever you like to call it, or even before that, if you can remember, your mother and father, and by and large, quite a lot of mothers and fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers struggled to put some kinds of food on the table. And the whole idea, of course, was to get you an education, right? You will go nowhere unless you go to school, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what started baby infants, I think, and it's usually the nuns, and the same with the boys, if it could be the national school and then the Christian Brothers, and the influence they had on you as such. And of course, we know that the class could contain 50 people unless you had resources to go to a private school. Yeah. And they were few and far between, and it was us and them, and it was always them could send their kids to whatever. Yeah. I won't mention the colleges, but
no, and there's no change today.
No, absolutely none whatsoever.
I got an email last night from a young teacher, secondary school teacher. He emailed the Minister for Sport, Shane Ross, I think it was. Mm. That two private schools had got a huge amount of grant monies. Mm. And it's just, he was complaining that some schools don't even have a hall for PE. Yeah. And here you have two private schools getting immense amounts of monies. And the point he was making was that, you know, the difference or the imbalance in society is exactly the same as it was way fado, there's no change,
Yes, and of course it was always them and they, but they were always being inspired to get like them, which quite a lot of people never attained, but they did, some of them did too badly now, and either be at a DCU now, and you want them to see the amount of young people there now. Quite a lot of them are non-nationals, But 16,800 there's a moment. It's spread over three campuses, but they are educating themselves, and maybe those that are not nationals are educating themselves to go home and educate somebody else. But that is the way forward. And of course now the digital age. If you told my grandmother that you could see things on a box, I'd be getting a box, I think. Yeah. Why you got mad? You'd end up in Grange Garmin or something like that, or that you could have a little thing in your hand called a telephone.
Yeah.
And then that day, of course, they had the telephone that was in a little green box, and you put all the pennies in.
That's
and
right, the yeah. press button there.
And yeah. you never got your refund.
You mentioned parents there. I think the one thing that I have to attribute to my parents is that in my day, there was this thing of knowing your station.
Oh, right? Yes.
And my parents, God be good to them, never subscribed to that. And they always said, you can do what you want to do, provided that you have the energy to get it.
And the ability to do.
So I think that was, they were different, I think, you know. And the second thing they always emphasised was this thing of reading. You know, the love of reading. Mm. And I think it's and I still maintain it's probably the biggest gift that any parent can give a child. Because if you can read, you know, you can do anything.
Yeah,
you know,
assess.
You can assess it. And I mean, I know we're in the modern age, we're talking about it, particularly here in the station, about media literacy. This idea that the media is owned by a small number of people, and they can tweak and they can influence the news.
Well,
so I mean, again, there's no change going back 67 years, I suppose. But the ability to be able to read around a subject and inform a view, and I think that the third thing that I would say that my mother in particular always had this view is that if you shook hands with somebody, that you shook them firmly, and you looked them in the face. Look them in the eyes and think to yourself that you're as good as the person you're meeting. Mm-hmm. So this idea of that somebody from a different social class was different to you, she maintained that that's utter nonsense. So these are the things that I was taught, I suppose, as a young child. And I mean, there's an interesting background. My father came from, I'm from Cork originally, as you probably gathered from my tone.
Why so?
But he came from a street called Half Moon Street.
Which I know where it is,
actually. Back at the Opera House.
Yeah.
And in those days, there was two dwelling houses, just two.
Yeah.
And one house, there lived a family, and the father was an RAC man.
Well, the barracks was not too far away.
That's right, down the road. And it was the house next door was where my father lived with his father. Now, my grandfather came from a Fenian background.
Oh.
Right? So you can imagine an RAC man next door. And he tells the story that he was instructed by his father, my grandfather, not to play with the RAC man's son.
Mm. Yeah.
And the grandfather came home early, saw the two of them playing, and he lost his temper and he beat him with a belt. So what I'm trying to get across is that this is the background where people maybe don't realise today how things can, maybe in the north of Ireland perhaps. So that background, that really taught me a lesson that, you know, we're all reared and we're all sort of formed by the mores of your family. Yeah. But the thing about it is that how my father did not pass on this rigid approach, okay. I have to say, because I think that he read so much and he had an open mind. He's always say, you know, you should have a Catholic interest with a small C, meaning universal.
Yeah.
And a very broad interest in every subject you can come across and form your own view then on it, you know.
Then you weren't supposed to express that view in some quarters.
Well, that leads on to when I was at school, in secondary school, I was always in trouble because I expressed my views. And there was one occasion where the principal, because I spoke up about something, wrote to my mother telling her to attend a meeting with him, and she duly arrived. My father, by the way, I should explain, was laid up. He got a brain tumour, a benign brain tumour, and as a young man, I remember him coming in from work as a small boy, and nothing could be done, and he died a very young man he was ill for 22 years, but you know, that's very sad. But anyway, so she reared us, I suppose, five of us. But she went to the meeting and he started off, whatever the issue I had raised, and she just looked at him and looked at me. She patted me on the hand and said, "Brother, if that's all you're worried about, you have an awful lot on your plate. Boy, go back to your class." Subject closed. Wonderful woman, you know. I mean, our parents, really, when you think of what they had to put up against, they were wonderful, weren't they?
Yeah, well, we had a class society, of course. There was us, them, and the others.
It still exists, Austin.
Yeah, and us was, of course, at the bottom of the pyramid, and somewhere even lower down than the bottom of the pyramid. You know, we had quite a lot of people who were dependent on casual work. And, of course, the docks was the big thing for that. And there was always that structure with regard to commerce. You had to know your place. You know, and you were talking about artisans' dwellings way back in the 1890s, and one had to have a permanent position, like a clerk or something similar to that. Yeah. And of course, the big thing to get in there, if one could get into Guinness's. That was a job for life and a pension.
That was the golden grail, wasn't it?
Oh, that was it. And, of course, there was all sorts of manoeuvring going on there, but we won't talk about that.
Well, actually, very interesting about how society worked. When I finished school, I did my leaving cert in 1966, and a local councillor knew that we were in, financially, we weren't very well off, as you can imagine. And in those days, I was being proposed to join the bank, which was...
The reference thing. From the Pope.
But you had to have a financial guarantor. And he arranged for a businessman to put up the cash guarantee. You had to have a sponsor. And this a bond. So this money would be put aside in case you ran off with the money. I just the thoughts of working a bank at that stage, and fair play to my mother, she needed the money, not to be honest with you. But she let me go, and I studied science. I became an industrial chemist because my mother decided that she didn't push me into something I didn't want to do. And there are an awful lot of people of my age ended up in jobs that they absolutely hated, and then they were trapped. Yeah, you know, so it's very sad. So I was lucky. I was very lucky.
Apprenticeships and that, and it was always a friend of the family who was a plumber or whatever. Try and put a good one in word for Johnny.
Wasn't it very strongly family based? Like, for example, a plumber. Grandfather and father.
Well, that was it, because it was like the army and the guards. You were talking about the RUC, but remember all the RUC people that with regard to the rank and file, and even a bit up after, they all had to be Irish.
Oh, this is the point.
They were Irish.
We forget this.
They were Irish. And it was up to the 1920s when they started to resign en masse because they didn't like what they had to do. And we got that day and night.
Yeah, my father told me that. My mother also would tell me that if you would cross the road other than walk on the same side as an RIC man, because you'd be afraid of being accused of being an informer.
Oh, yeah.
You wouldn't talk to a policeman.
Oh, because you would speak to him.
Yeah.
You know, that was the risk. So, I mean, that's the history we come from,
That would be from about the 1900s onwards, you know. But of course, before that, we had all sorts of political divisions with Parnell and etc. And we know what happened to poor old Parnell. And that was the society we lived in. And of course, it's now only coming to light. We lived in a very dark society as well. A hidden Ireland, they call it. And it's only now, in the last couple of years, there's all sorts of reports of all sorts of abuse and all sorts of things. But poor children, they didn't offend anybody. Maybe the father died and the mother had four or five children, maybe six children.
That's right, yeah.
And not able to support them.
I heard a programme yesterday talking about on Sunday, Mary Finucane talk, not Mary Finucane, what's the other girl? She was talking earlier, RT Sunday morning programme, but she was talking about women from the Magdalen Laundry from Hyde Park, which is not too far away.
Yeah, well, I was...
Absolutely horrific.
in Hyde Park, and I saw the conditions in there. And now, having said that, the nuns made sure that you didn't see anything. But the women, we used to hear them praying, right? And we were wondering, well, we heard this noise, and we didn't know what it was. And it was continuous. So one fella, a very curious fella, climbed up on the ladder and looked in the window. And they were all praying while they were working. That's what was making the noise.
Oh, so it was a constant noise.
Yeah. And that applied all over the place.
But there was one woman talking about that her family thought she was going to a boarding school. So the state was paying money in, the family was putting money in, and she was working the laundry.
You know, the route is coming up now that they were given nothing and there's all sorts of business. But there's very few of them left. And, of course, they were programmed to death. It could be a 19-year-old that went. And normally, I did a bit of research into this over the years. And, you know, the Magdalen Laundries started off in England with very, very good intentions, and then they moved to Limerick.
Is that the route, Limerick first, was it?
Yeah, and quite a lot of spinster aunts and all that thought that Mary was going off the rails a bit. Maybe thought. She didn't attend church or didn't want. And she advised the mother, put in, she'd get a good education and all this. Education. I don't know what sort of an education that would be. Particularly when, and of course, the young fellows were the same. Artane. It had a notorious name. Now, I don't know how accurate that was, but the threat was, if you don't behave yourself, you will end up in Artane.
And the other one was... Out in Connemara, what was that one?
Letterfrack.
It's a college now of GMIT, a furniture college.
Is it? Yeah.
And it's amazing. I was there. I part of my job involved going out there because we got to do with courses and all that. But in the old building, you still get a sense. There's something about the place.
Well, they're all the same. You can nearly smell it as soon as you go in.
And the high windows and... It's chilling, you know?
Nothing short of jail in some circumstances. And regimentated to death.
Another thing about my mother, we're talking about parents and all that, but we were down going to a funeral or something. We were passing this place. I think it's called Beresford or some name like that. But I asked my mother what it was, and she said, oh, that's a home for unmarried mothers. And in my innocence, but just give you an idea of maybe how I was thinking, I said, where's the home for the unmarried fathers? And my mother said, son, it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. And as a young boy, I also remember the injustice of it. You know, this idea that, and it's still going to this day, that the women are the source of evil and the lead men on all this. Absolutely horrific.
Utter nonsense too. But then, of course, it was all about control.
Control, you're
control,
right.
Control was it. Yeah. And the clergy were put up on pedestals.
Yeah.
And the teachers were something, maybe just a step lower than it. But of course, if it was a Christian brother, that was a different number.
It was definitely a pecking order.
Oh,
it?
Definitely a pecking order. I mean, you got down to the army. Primary school teacher who had about 50 kids to look after, and the only way he could look after them was with the cane.
Another episode I'm talking about, maybe this might ring a bell also with you, but after Mass one Sunday, we had to stay behind for some reason, and I saw over in the side chapel, the rails, a woman kneeling and two candles and a priest, and this, you know, and I said, what's going on there? And she said, well, that woman has been churched. And I said, I never know what that meant. And she said, oh, she's after having a baby.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, that's a celebration. Oh, no, no, she says, she couldn't receive the sacraments until she was churched.
She was unclean.
And I said, where's the father? And she said, son, lesson number two, it doesn't work like that. Now, apparently there's a link goes back to the Jewish faith where there was something, you know, but... You mentioned control. I think it was control. And I got into trouble at school because I said it in an essay that this was a control of womanhood. You know, but did you hear that before?
Well, no. It's actually only recently that the term being churched came. I had absolutely no idea what it was or what it was about.
Yeah, the only reason I experienced it is that I saw it as a young fella, and I asked my mother, and she told me. But it ran on for quite a while, you know.
I think it went on till the '60s. If I'm not, well, I might be exaggerating. Yeah, but I know cases that. The young daughter, not young, the daughter, right, could be 29 or maybe that was considered young enough anyway. It could be dragged down, and she mightn't be well, dragged down to the church and the whatever the priest was officiating on it.
See, I think probably, like you mentioned a while ago, something started with good intentions.
Oh, everything starts with good
intentions. But then it's manipulated back to control, you know.
Yeah. The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Well said,
and possibly, I felt that a lot was to do with education. Like, the power of the clergy, apart from the preaching, but they were all educated people.
Correct.
And like, the bishop was a very educated man, and he would know better than most parents. I mean, parents never queried or contradicted, not alone the church, but even like the headmaster in the school. If the headmaster says your Johnny is a bald little brat, you believed it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's quite the opposite nowadays. Parents stick up for the children.
Even if they're wrong.
Well, even if they're wrong, well, that's true.
I think the wheel has around,
90 degrees at its own. But then again, of course, it was the bishop or the local bishop who appointed the people to the schools.
Of course.
Now, the state paid for them.
Yeah.
But if they hadn't got the nod from the bishop or whoever it was, they didn't get the job. And of course, it was rigorous. Investigations into the background.
I'm involved in a stage drama group, and we did a play called Dancing at Lunasa there recently. Yeah. And in the play, one of the sisters is a teacher, and she loses her job because her brother was sent back from the missions because of he went native or whatever.
Yeah.
But the bottom center, to illustrate the point you're making, the local parish priest had the power to hire and fire.
Yeah.
And she lost her job because of that reason. And so, you know, as a result, you know, power corrupts. You know, we're all guilty. If we're all in that position that we can find. If we're put in a pedestal and we have this amount of power with no balance, that corruption can creep in, you know.
We're coming around to spin now. It's gone nowadays. Yeah.
Just another point that struck me about my mother, when, as she got older, I had a fantastic job. I worked in Enterprise Ireland. It had different names before that, but it was a semi-state body, but my conditions were fantastic. And she could never understand. She could never understand my work conditions were so good compared to when she was working, the pay and the time off, and she could never figure it out. But one thing she was always saying about income tax, I'd be complaining. She said, "Listen, you must be earning it to be paying
to
it."
Note, I think we have to just take a break, and maybe we just play a little bit of music. We have a few more minutes. Like you were saying, you have to be earning it to pay it. And of course, nobody likes paying tax. And we have seen in recent history that people who were earning ginormous amounts of money were contributing to the state. The old Cinderella clause applied. You could just drive over the border and ring back home and come back again. You were out of the country for...
I mean, I was fascinated to see in an article in the Sunday Times can't think of her name now, the journalist, but she was saying that this very point about the wages, that the banks at the moment, there's talk that the executives are going to get five salary increases. Yeah. And you have a bank, which one of the banks owes 10 billion. Mm. Yet you got 20 billion, it still owes 10, Yeah. They pay back half, in other words. And yet they're going to pay the executives these huge salaries. Well, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, don't go there with it.
It's not performance-based, you see. It's not performance-based. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's mind-based. You know, I got this job and I have to do this, and I expect this fantastic salary for it and this fantastic pension following it.
Well, that's the other thing, yeah. I mean, people say...
Or severance pay.
Yeah, they wouldn't be able to hire somebody. Nobody would work for $500,000.
I would.
I'm just going to say.
See, they won't take the job unless there's a foolproof contract, you know. Yeah.
Now, this is the Senior Citizens Programme, and we have Mr. Cahalan and Mr. Kelly in, and they're going to be discussing school days, you know. And it wasn't Billy Bunter's type school days now at all. It was Christian Brother type school days, by and large. And, of course, we have to mention the nuns as well, and the Holy Orders and that time period. And, of course, they're all practically gone. And having said that, when Daniel O'Connor got a hold of the schools that the Church got, well, that was 1829, but it took a little bit of years after that. But, well, of course, the state could have run them, and they wanted to run some schools, but it would be only just the primary, basic, arithmetic. The three R's,
yeah.
And that type of thing. Yeah. And then apparently you had to have a slate around it with a bit of chalk and all sorts of things. And if you spoke Irish, they made to put a little wooden tag on you with a bit of string and a little bit square bit of wood with a hole on it.
And you were
to be invited, yeah. Now, that was at the very, very early
because
stage.
Because you spoke Irish, Gaelic.
Yeah, they were trying to,
kill
the
Gaelic.
Yeah.
It was like leprosy, unclean, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's how they broke it.
That was one of the times. And they did all sorts of other things. They gave everybody licenses that wants to sell beer. Every even shop they wanted. You know, some villages had about 12 pubs in it. And about 30 houses, you know? Yeah. This type of thing. All these things were designed, you know, going back to Trevelyan and all that other crowd, right? Now, we can call them all the things we like, but they're well since gone.
On that point, in Cork, the price of butter was decided every morning in the butter exchange, in the butter market.
And that's the worldwide.
Worldwide. Yeah. I only found that out recently. We exported so much butter and food at that stage. We were a major, major exporter of food to the empire.
Yeah.
And the price of butter was decided
on the morning.
I think every noon or sometimes.
Yeah, there was big scales or something.
That's right. And the butter used to come in firkins, is that what you call it?
Little barrels.
But that's just coming to pay there.
And then put out lace with salt, of course, to keep it.
Then
there was inspectors to make sure that everything was. They inspected milk as well. Must remember.
I was in college, I remember visiting a large dairy called CMP, would be like Avonmore or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm going back 1960.
The year before last.
Seven. 1967, yeah. And we made this visit. But this guy was there. I mean, this is technology was only beginning to come in, I suppose.
Yeah.
But he was known as a sniffer, right? And I was fascinated by this.
I thought this was a dog.
but as the milk churns would come in, this is before the trucks now, there was the churns.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
The lorry would come in with the churns and he'd lift the lid, sniff, right?
To make sure it was fresh.
But his nose, the human nose is incredible apparently, because it can pick up parts per million. But he would know if something was about to go off.
Wow.
Or there was too much water in it.
Or whatever, he would know, and he would put it aside or whatever, and that was his job.
Yeah.
Well,
and then they have they have electronic things that. But he was apparently remarkably accurate.
Wow.
So that you wouldn't contaminate the full batch.
Yeah, I see that.
So, when you say that to some people today, like, they look at you and say, well, why couldn't it be tested? But it just goes to show that they've mimicked the nose now, the human nose. Amazing.
And just bring back to mind, Porter's rum from Jamaica, and the porter on the ship, it would be it took weeks and weeks to go anywhere, would be buying rum, and he wouldn't smell it, but he set fire to it And of he knew course. By the flame. By the flame. Flame. And it's still called Porter's rum.
Whether it was fuck strong or weak. Yeah.
Well, it was up there. Yeah, yeah. It was made from molasses. Yeah, and, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, yeah. And because the sailor's grog was diluted yeah. rum, wasn't it?
Yeah, they got so much a yeah. day.
And so that's very good that the flame yeah, the content would show up. Very yeah. good. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's when we get back to Cork. We won't stay in Jamaica.
That's supposed to be one of the tests for poteen as well, isn't it?
It's the same idea.
The colour of the flame or how strong the flame is.
Yeah. I remember poteen, the same thing. My wife is
illegally.
my wife is from Newport in Tipperary.
Oh.
There was a time where there was well known in those areas for production of that illicit.
Not in Mayo.
And. But apparently, it was a lot of people, sports people, would look for it because they'd mix vinegar and the poteen together as a rub.
Yes.
That was always the excuse when they were in court. For rubbing down the greyhound.
Yeah, exactly, on the horse or whatever.
Well, if you were caught with it, that was the excuse.
That was the
excuse.
Yeah, it was the call. Rheumatism.
My scoutmaster, Fado Fado, he was a big man into the cine cameras.
Yeah.
And we took part in a movie, mini movie, making poteen.
Oh, right. Yeah.
God, where has this come from? It just came into my head. And I won a prize or whatever, and we all got a small a box of sweets or something. Like that
stuff. Yeah, yeah.
But we got it. It was poteen, yeah.
God. That's what got you into drama. It was a drink.
in the young days, as a young apprentice in the, let's say, the electrical business, I was, because I was a young fella, I was sent out on all the country runs, and I was with an experienced guy, like, you know, he was a charge hand. And it turned out we were in this particular pub up near this town up near the border, where every fifth shop in the main street was a pub.
Yeah.
For God's sake.
And his
every fifth shop.
Yeah. Honest to God, yeah. My goodness. Every fifth shop.
Not just town had 15
there was 12,
pubs.
There were 12 to 14 pubs in this. Yeah. In this.
How do they all do business?
Well, that's the strength. But anyway, his tune-in was, and of course every day we finished at 5, half 5. Sometimes we'd work till 6 in the evening. Mm. And his first thing was, we were there for 14 days, 2 weeks. So he was going to have a drink in every single pub. But in every pub he asked... He was looking for poteen, he says. Now, what's the test for poteen? And what do you do this and what do you do that? So eventually, by the time we got to pub number 8, I was only drinking orange juice, you know.
He could hardly see it.
No, well, by the time we got to pub number 8, sort of on day 5 or 6, the whole town knew, this bloody guy is looking for poteen, like, and he's asking all these questions. You put this in it and you taste it and you burn it and all the different tests that you do. So this fella at the counter, who I knew, he may not have known, but I knew because of his dress, he was a guard, because he still had the blue shorts and the navy trousers. But maybe my boss, as he would have been, maybe he was a little bit addled in the brain from the few pints in the pubs. And he asked, he says, do you know anything about poteen? He says, you know, what's the test for it? And I always remember what this guy said. Now, he definitely was a guard. And he says, do you know what? An intelligent fella like you, why would you be drinking poteen? You know?
when we were in college, very interesting, though, another thing came into my head. The lecturer had a sample of poteen. And we did a test where we were able to put it into a machine and we give these a graph of output.
Yeah.
But my God, what really came across, he was actually telling, I don't drink and never did, but the other guys in my class would drink it off a scabby leg, as they said.
Yeah.
But he was illustrating that poteen, unless it's well distilled, contains things like diesel and all these chemicals, which are very dangerous.
Yeah.
And he showed, say, ordinary alcohol, and you could see the difference. It was so clean compared to the other one. So... You know, there's a lesson in there. I mean, good poteen is triple distilled or something like that. And the first wash is deadly stuff, you know.
Well, it's legal now. You can buy legal poteen.
Yeah, but they have license to make it. That's for export, believe it or not.
Yeah. I was the only guy in college in my class. We had a small class. I did chemical technology, you know. But anyway, but there was only about 12 of us. And I was the only one who didn't drink. So I was in one or two pints in those days. The fellas would be half shot, you know.
Yeah.
But I had to do the talking to explain that they were misbehaving or whatever, because I was the sober one, you know. God, the innocence.
You land up in Milltown, I can tell you, you're in land.
You mentioned there about a teacher saying to you, threatening you with all sorts of things. Yeah. We had a teacher, and he said to a fellow, "You won't even have the qualifications to apply for a messenger boy's job if you don't do your tests or whatever."
What was the other one we used to get now? If brains were gunpowder, you wouldn't have enough to blow the hair off your head.
Yeah. But we're talking there off air about the good teachers.
Yeah.
I mean, I was very lucky. I had a great education in terms of, you know, apart from one teacher in first year in secondary school who was an animal, the rest of them were all gentlemen, and I was very lucky. But the impact of a good teacher, you know, is affects you for the rest of your life, I think, you know. And my daughter is a primary teacher, and when her friends would come to the house, I'd be always saying to them, listen, the impact you're going to have on a child, you know, it will live forever. And of course, as young people, then the clue really, they had the theory end of it. But it really hits home, because I was saying to them, the real test you'll have is where you're teaching a child that you don't like. And human life is like that.
That's true, yeah.
And one of the girls said to me, one of my daughter's friends said, Mr. Cal, I have a child in my class and I thought of you the other day. I said, thought of me? Because he says, he's a bowel so-and-so and you said that he's the child that you got to teach, which is it's very hard now. I think teaching job in today is a very difficult
it's
job.
A tough job,
because the discipline attitudes we referred to earlier on are so different.
And that brings me back to the Christian Brothers. The Christian Brothers always pick the most intelligent, I found, in the class, and they give with them all that. And if you were put to the back of the class if you were a dunce or whatever.
Oh, right, yeah.
And this stigma applied, like this is, which went back long before your parents' time, this stigma, they didn't put dunces' hats on them.
That's right, that's right.
And
the other thing is that you'd be compared to your siblings.
Oh, yeah.
If your brother or whatever went beforehand. You'd be compared, you know? I always found it, no wonder I got into trouble, because I thought this was...
You're a rogue.
I taught your brother and he was a good pupil and you'll never be as good as that.
I'll never be a messenger boy.
That's right. It's amazing, isn't it, how... Now, as I said, had you any bad experiences with teachers that stuck with you?
Not really. No, they were all good. And in much later years, I mean, a couple of the teachers who taught me in primary school are still alive. And I've actually sought them out and found them just to say,
I'll go away.
Just in case you were wondering how I got on, because like I had three or four brothers and we all had the same teachers, you know. And this brother did this and this brother did that.
I'll go away.
And I often wondered how you got. Now, we often think about our various pupils that they had, and the super intelligent ones, okay, they see them in the news because they've written books or they're lecturing such and such. But we often wonder about the other ones, where they went.
There was a thing on the radio, I interpreted it last week, where they spoke about some school, some teacher had died, and there was people flying back from abroad to attend a funeral. Yeah. Look at the impact that man had on those children.
Yes, that's
and they're all in their 40s and whatever. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, teaching is, you know, it's such an important thing. And the way we hand our children over to teachers, when you think about it, you know,
Of course, nowadays, the teachers are trying to import knowledge about all digital stuff at the moment. That's one of the big debates, and it's going to go on and on and on.
Well, this thing of what age should a child get a smartphone?
And bullying and cyberbullying. Pupils, were badly affected, and some of them very badly affected, and they ended their own lives and all that type of thing. So, when you're talking about pupils, they're not all like coming to one package.
Correct.
Like the fellas with the one eye, you know.
Yeah. Actually, David Coleman, the child psychologist, I heard him then recently, said that before bullying would tend to stop at the school gate.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't, because of the phones.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but they take the phones off.
Afterwards.
Oh, they get collect them going out
and
the door.
And this thing goes on. Apparently.
And did you ever witness bullying at school in your school days?
It didn't
stop at the gate.
No, but
it wasn't on the way home that the fella beat you up and took your lunch or anything.
Yeah,
like
the point he was making is that the digital thing is that psychologically it apparently has a bigger impact. That this constant drip of hate mail or whatever it is, apparently can be very eroding on a young person's mind.
Trying to program them. Basically. But and my mothers and fathers say, if you mention this, what are you talking about? You've gone off your rocker. We had the wireless with the big valves in it.
Do you remember that?
And Joe Linane and all of that. Actually, it was in the studios. It was over the GPO. It went in from Henry Street.
Yeah.
There were only a couple of little rooms as such.
There's a great story told about Harry Thulier. Do you remember Harry?
The fencing man.
But they used to do a program on a Saturday afternoon. And... what's his name? Terry Wogan was involved in it.
I knew Wogan. Terry Wogan.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But apparently Harry Thulier, the thing about it is that he could never be fazed, apparently, no matter what happened. They decided they'd have to test it, right? And the results, he used to do the results at the end.
Okay.
And he was reading out the results and they lit it. They set it on fire, right?
And
he continued without drawing a breath. He made up the teams.
The football, my heart's racing.
Shaggy Ball Rovers 2-11. I kept going.
And the smoke alarm didn't go off.
I mean, when you think of it, happened? A bit
messy.
But I mean, nowadays fellas are going to get up in jail for this, you know?
The
things we used to do at work, I mean, in the 70s, I started work in 1971. I came to Dublin in 1971. And the tricks that were played on people, you know, I mean, what was the one? You'd be sent up to stores for the long wait.
A pocket of compression.
For the skirt and all
that. A left-handed screwdriver.
The sky hook.
Actually, there is a thing called a left-handed screwdriver, believe it.
My sister...
Is that a cocktail, is it?
My sister worked in an engineering works, and this guy came in, she worked in the office, and the guy came in asking her to order a bastard file, and she said, the cheek of you using that language to me. And apparently a bastard file
is
the opposite way or something like that. And he kept trying to explain, get out, she said, I'll report you.
She thought it was another trick.
She thought he was using bad language. Boss had to come in and say it's actually called, you know.
But nowadays, of course, one has to be very politically correct where women are concerned. And you see what's going on at the moment. And now that may have happened in your mother and father's time, but it was buried very, very quickly, you know.
I discovered, actually not long before I left work, I was talking to a group of girls one time, and a conversation came up about somebody was mentioned as a toucher. You know,
people looking for money.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what. And afterwards, this colleague of mine came back and she said, you hadn't a clue, had you? I said, what is that all about? She says, a fellow is known as a toucher who inappropriately touches women. Now, this happened within the last 10 years. So I was fascinated at this. And she said, I touch people. No, she says, you're tactile.
Yeah.
And I said, what? when you touch, I would tend to touch people in conversation or whatever. Yeah. She said, that's not what we're talking about. So it's going on in society. Yeah. I thought that was a thing in the past. Just goes to show, it is covered up. And I said to this particular girl, did it happen to you? She said, it did. And I said, well, what did you do? I stood up and slapped him.
That's a permanent answer.
Yeah. And I said, you know, the fellow could sue her probably for that then, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's awful, isn't it?
Did you ever get slapped across the face?
Did I?
By a lady, I mean.
Thankfully, no.
No.
Yeah. I have to be honest.
I just remember.
Did I ever get a slap? My sister might have given me a belt, maybe, all right, for misbehaving or something, maybe.
And I remember there were three or four, the usual thing, going to the Saturday night hop, and there was always some girls that you thought fancied you, because they kept looking at you and they seemed to appear in front of you all the time. And for some reason, you avoided them. I mean, nowadays you
it's an amazing
think of that, but you were avoiding them. But I remember once saying, oh, well, I everywhere I go, I see that girl sitting in front of I'll ask her up to dance. And I went over and asked her up to dance. She gave me a slap across the face.
How dare you?
And I was looking at her, what'd you do that for? How dare you ask me up to dance?
What?
So years later, came across, the girl was happily married now. Yeah, and I asked her, and she said, I really fancied you, and you were a dream thing that I had, like, you know, and because I asked her up to dance,
you broke the bubble.
Yeah.
The illusion was gone.
Talking about things, another story about my mother, I discovered before she died that when she was going dancing, she was pretend she lived in the Western Road. Which is
I know where the well there.
A very posh area.
Yeah, all the way. But
oh yeah,
she'd walk. You know,
up to the skyscraper.
Yeah, well, not that far. Not that far. Up near the college gates, maybe. But she would pretend to go in this driveway, but it was actually an alleyway, and she'd go in the back and go back to the dance.
I see.
So
yeah,
we
yeah.
saw a slagger saying, "Ma, you misbehaved," you know.
But that was the thing, we had motorbikes, you see,
bicycles was the thing of my day, if you could afford them. And of course, all the males sat on that side, the left hand side of the ballroom, and all the females in the long, really
dresses.
The stuff like, well,
do you remember underskirts?
We never got that far. The overskirts.
I remember my sister going dancing with these underskirts made of tulle, is it?
Oh, yeah, this is to make them stand out.
This would be now in the early
60s. Oh, yeah, when you dance, so they
stand. Yeah, correct. You know, like in one of the big movies there, Olivia Newton-John, Grease.
Yeah, that sort of stuff.
But I remember going dancing. I was fascinated by this. Yards and yards of this stuff, you know.
The new look.
The new look, indeed.
You with your bicycle. You know, some girls and all, they wanted to lift home.
The crossbar.
You know, well, that would be the thing. But the thing you never thought of saying, like, you know, where do you live? Like, you know,
5 miles away.
I live in Wicklow or I live in Donegal, you know.
Where I used to live in Cork, the townland was known as Killarine Downey.
Right.
Yeah. It was an old name. Okay. And it would be, where I lived in Cork was maybe a half hour walk from the city centre. If my sister didn't, if somebody asked her home and she didn't want to go but didn't want to refuse him, he'd say, where do you live? And she'd say, Killarine Downey. So your man thought it was 40 miles
away. Yeah.
How do you know Cork, Austin?
Oh, I know every
bump
in Cork.
Why, did you work there?
Yeah, I used to be up and down there all the time.
Oh, go away.
Yeah, the exile big so.
The Arcadia. I was in the Arcadia a few times. Yeah, it's the Arcadia Apartments now, isn't
it? It's opposite the station.
But then on the other corner there was a cinema.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't think we have time to be the cinema at the moment. I think we've.
When you walked out, would you go down and come back at weekends or up and down?
Oh yeah, we used to get the train mostly. Yeah.
You're going to say you didn't go on the bicycle, no?
Yeah. I did that too. Actually.
Did you bring the bike?
No, but I cycled from Dublin to Cork. We used to get the train. You get a weekend, and it was almost expensive. And I would hate to be going now. You get to Bulgaria cheaper.
I mean, if you go in England on the train, it's very expensive.
Oh, very expensive.
Very expensive.
I remember one of our friends, his father was a station master or worked in one of the stations in Dublin, in the city. And there used to be the thing, the mystery train. On a Saturday or a Sunday, the mystery train was going somewhere. Yeah. Now, sometimes it was only to Bray, and sometimes it was to Drogheda.
And the radio train's the same thing.
But when it was Limerick or Cork, he would know. And he would tell his son, who was our pal, and we'd all go for £1 or £2. And we would... Now, if we were going to Cork, we knew someone in Cork. It's not like a student crash or whatever like that, but we knew someone in Cork we could stay with. So for a pound, we went down to Cork on the day train, right? On the mystery train. And the ticket was a grey ticket that was broken in half, one for the return. And when you got down there, you got someone in the station and you got a pound from them, because it was £4 or £5 to Dublin to give him a ticket.
So there's your return.
So you got your money back,
You
got your money back.
Enterprise.
Very good.
So there we go.
Very good.
I'm talking about the mystery train. I'll have to tell you again some other time, but a person came up from Galway and he was bringing his girlfriend and he went in the mystery train and he ended up in Galway. So, on that note, I think we will end up here and get our breath back. But I have no doubt we'll be back to it sometime sooner or later. Sure. And on that note, I'd like to thank Jim for coming in and Declan. And,
pleasure.
And we could be talking for a month, but we have to stop now. Your man's banging on the window.
Really enjoyed it. It was good.
Bye. Yeah. Bye till next week.